Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Where is the line between who a person is as a human being and the erratic and even dangerous behaviors brought on by severe mental illness? Before she was in preschool, Mira Bartok's alcoholic father had abandoned the family, leaving her schizophrenic mother alone to raise her and her sister. Even while enduring her mother's obsessions, paranoid delusions, and frequent hospitalizations, Bartok managed to never lose sight of the deep and tender love her mother had for her daughters. As an adult, Bartok tried desperately to get her mother the care she needed, and her love didn't waver even when her mother's illness left her homeless, disruptive, and occasionally violent, or when a pair of separate accidents left Bartok struggling to rebuild her own life in the wake of traumatic brain injury. The memoir by author and artist Mira Bartok is called The Memory Palace. It's available now in trade paperback. Mira, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Do you have any recollection of your mother before her illness was a nearly constant factor in your life?
Actually, I don't. But I do have some memories, very, very vague memories, when I was really small of her being less ill in the sense that just being a little more present. Mm-hmm. But I only remember her being either very, very disaffected and depressed and ill in that way, or talking to herself, and going into a kind of psychotic episode, which is, she would cycle into those. But now I don't remember her being well at all, sad to say.
You write about a time when you were, I guess, 5 or 6, and you walked into the living room to see who she must be talking to. And you see her talking to herself. She's walking in circles. She's agitated. She's waving a knife. And it's so interesting because you were struck even then that she reminded you of what you'd been told about the Greek figure Medusa.
Yeah, my mother, one of the wonderful things about my mother was that she was so brilliant and well-read. And she read to my sister and me, Greek myths, Alice in Wonderland, all these wonderful stories and legends and myths. So I think I had a lot of these stories grounded in my brain from early on.
You do such a wonderful job in this book of making us understand how it was that you were able to maintain this extraordinary, abiding love for your mother, despite how difficult your life was with her. And one of the things you do is include things from letters that she had sent you, and also around the time she was dying, you found that she'd been keeping really extensive diaries for decades.
Mm. Yeah, she kept 17... She started writing in her writing journals, as far as I know. I never found anything from before that period, but she started writing diaries after we separated, after we lost touch with one another in 1990. So she kept 17 years of diaries.
Hmm. What an interesting look into the mind of someone with this illness and how it must feel to try and make sense of the world despite all of these delusions.
Yeah, I think that yes, her writing was really disturbing, but it also proved that she was sort of a poetic, lyrical writer. Mm-hmm. And I think had she been able to channel that in some other way, and she hadn't been, if she had not been ill, she might have become a great poet. I don't know, but one of the things I was struck with was not just her delusions, but also her constant obsession with where is she going to get something to eat? How is she going to get something to eat? How much money does she have left? This is the constant obsession with someone who has no home.
Mm-hmm.
Will she have to spend the night on the street? And it's not just giving you a peek into the mind of someone who is mentally ill, but also someone who has no shelter.
I also really loved that your writing about her and also the things that you included from her writing remind us that she, even though she was mentally ill, even though she was homeless, she still had a sort of intellectual life that to the extent possible, and often it was not very much, she tried to feed.
Oh, my God, yeah. She, that was, one of the things that struck me the most as well. And when I met women from the shelter who had sort of looked at, my mother lived in a, you know, a shelter, went in the shelter the last 3 years of her life, and they all said that she got up at 5 in the morning, she walked out that door, and she went to study at the library, and she went to the art museum, and she, you know, she kept copious notes on things. She wanted to learn everything in the world and every language, and, you know, she was rather a savant in that way.
Your mother had some unusual obsessions brought on by her illness. She was very afraid of sexual violence, and there are some explanations for that. But she also had sort of an obsession with being Jewish and the Nazis out to get her. Any idea where that came from?
Well, you know, you think about my you know, she was born in 1926, mm-hmm. and when she graduated from high school, 1945, that summer, we, you know, I think we dropped the bomb in 1945. My history is not really great at the moment. But,
yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, and she knew a lot of young boys. You know, she grew up in a very, very Jewish neighborhood on the east side of Cleveland, very poor Jewish neighborhood. And some of the boys she went to school with lost their lives in the war. Some of them went off and never came back. And, you know, her mother came out of her mother, my grandma Anna, that family had immigrated because of pogroms in Russia. So there was always this, you know, this sense of you're Jewish, you're different. Don't tell don't tell anyone because someone could hurt you. And I grew up in a very Catholic and Baptist neighborhood, very, very Christian. I didn't know any other Jews, and so I was aware of my otherness, even though we weren't raised religiously at all. I just think that kind of when you are schizophrenic, you are prone to paranoid delusions, and that I think that's probably a natural one for a lot of people who were raised Jewish.
I'm curious about the extent to which you and your sister were affected by your mother's fears when you were very young. Because when we're a certain age, we just assume that our parents know everything and they must be right about everything.
That's a really good question. You know, I don't think anyone's ever asked me that. You know, I think that, the mother is the mirror, is your first mirror to the world.
Yeah.
And sort of the, you know, you think about how should you be in the world, you know, when you look at your mother, you know, what emotion is this person reflecting back at you? That's your sense of, you know, your first sense of self in a way. I don't know. My sister and I are very, very different. I think that in some ways she was more fearless than I was. In some ways, I was much more fearless. I think that, you know, when I was very, very shy, dreadfully shy when I was really little, but then I kind of grew out of that. I don't know. You know, I still see things many, many years later and how it affects us. I think, you know, for my sister, going without financial security was really pretty horrible. And so she chose a path, you know, of having a secure job. Teaching job, whereas for me, I was more afraid of anyone controlling what I did. And mm-hmm. so I always had to be entrepreneurial, even if it meant suffering financially. So those are the adult kinds of things. But as little children, I don't know, given the, you know, how my mother was, I think I was kind of a brave little kid in some ways. I used to go, by myself all over on the subway. Probably shouldn't have. I would go into the woods. I wasn't afraid of the natural world. And, you know, part of that came from early neglect. Early on, our mother was very neglectful, but when we reached puberty, she became really controlling. So I think that we had so much neglect early on that we just kind of ran around and fearlessly, like little feral children, you know. So I don't know. I don't know if that really answers your question. I think I'm still thinking about that kind of thing. What am I afraid of? What, even as an adult, many years later, have some of her fears become my fears? I don't know. Sorry, I'm just not sure.
Now, did you ever wonder, did you ever worry that you might inherit schizophrenia?
You know, I never did.
Really?
And I don't know why. I think that my sister worried if she had children that they would become schizophrenic. Mm-hmm. I never really worried about that either, although neither of us had children. And I remember when I was married to someone else, my first husband, you know, I wanted to go to genetic counselor to sort of talk about that. So I was more worried about, you know, giving birth to a schizophrenic child, but I wasn't terribly worried about it for some reason. I tend not to be much of a worrywart, and I have no idea why that is. I think, you know, I've been through so much that it's like, okay, I, you know, I'm just so grateful I'm here, and I'm grateful that I have the life I have now.
Well, let's step back and talk about that for a minute, because on top of everything else, and you'd sort of been dealing with your mother your entire life, and then you had, within the span of, I guess it was 9 months, you had a terrible head injury from slipping on the ice, and then you had a really serious car wreck. What was it like waking up the morning after your car accident and realizing you were not okay?
I don't remember. I don't remember much. But it was very disoriented. I was very disoriented. All I remember is just kind of wandering around in my apartment, not really sure why, like from one room to the next, not really sure why I was there.
Hmm.
I woke up, you know, we all talk about aging after 40. You know, our hearing goes, or after 50, our hearing goes, our eyesight goes, all this stuff. For me, it was overnight. So when people, you know, when people try to make me feel better by saying, oh, I have that problem too. Oh, everyone has that. It actually, you know, when someone has a brain injury or some other invisible disability like fibromyalgia or lupus or something, it doesn't actually make them feel better by saying that because it, you know, for me it happened overnight. I no longer could see close. I no longer could read more than a paragraph at a time. I couldn't hear properly. My balance was totally off. I would get, you know, all these things. I don't want to sound like a victim. A lot of people, you know, have experienced the same thing, especially people coming home from Afghanistan and Iraq. Certainly, you know, TBI is the signature, injury over there. But, it was just my sense of self was really, it was really lost for a while because who was I? Who was I if I couldn't really remember one thing to the next? Who was I if I couldn't write stories, if I couldn't draw pictures, if I couldn't play music, all these things that I loved? I wasn't sure who I was, and it took a while to get that back.
And ironically, because, I mean, the other sad thing about TBI is that you look fine, so people don't look at you and think, well, she needs we need to give her a break.
Oh, and even now, I mean, like I knew that I was going to be on the radio today.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't talk to anyone today. I didn't have any conversation. I made sure that I stayed in and I didn't have any kind of stimulation. If I had gone to the grocery store and been walking in fluorescent lights and seeing all the choices around me and have you know, if I had driven the 20 minutes it took to get there and maybe I'd run into someone who'd talk to me, and then I'd come back. Could I speak to you so with, you know, and sound mildly articulate? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not.
Mira Bartok is my guest. She's an artist and author of the memoir, The Memory Palace. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. And if you'd like to join us, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author and artist Mira Bartok. Her book is called The Memory Palace, A Memoir. It's available now in trade paperback. If you'd like to join us, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Mira, you and your sister are just a year apart. Things took a turn for the worse when you reached adolescence, in that you had grown up as small children adjusting to this sort of benign neglect, and then it's all the much harder to be smothered effectively as you got older.
Yeah, it felt like, I basically felt like I was invisible. And then, boom, I hit puberty, and then I'm living under a surveillance camera, and the surveillance camera is on 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. Even when I go to school, my mother's circling the school on her bike, or when I try to go to sleep, or my sister and I, tried to go to sleep, and our mother would come in all hours of the night and wake us up and interrogate us about, the men she imagined doing things to us, It was not a picnic, I have to say. I'm so lucky I had my sister. I don't know what it would have been like to not have had someone close to me like that.
Yeah, it's really a remarkable thing. And reading the book, we're glad you have each other as well. Just sort of a sane voice to say, is this really happening? Yes, it's really happening, and this is what it is. I empathize with you and how that must have been socially. And then I also am struck, the part of me that is a parent imagines how terrifying it must have been for her to try and protect children that you loved when the entire world is so baffling and so terrifying all the time.
You mean terrifying for my mother?
For your mother, yes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you take this woman who has no money and is, on her own, getting very little help from our grandparents. She's a single mom and she's got these two little kids and she's hearing all these voices. She's seeing all these hallucinations. What's to tell her that they're not true and not real? Just being a single mom in and of itself, would be enough. But then to have this affliction, I think it. When you're a little kid, or especially when you're a teen, and your whole world revolves around yourself, you don't really, you don't often do empathy really well, but, as you get older, you say, I think now that I have stepdaughters, I think, oh, my God, my mother, my poor mother, what, just trying to survive and have these two kids and being so ill and not getting the social help, much help from the social system.
Well, she was really sick at a time when, in the United States, we were sort of shifting our system of caring for the mentally ill, in part by well-intentioned people who wanted to make up for the really abusive conditions in a lot of mental institutions in the past. But it left a lot of people, including your mother, really with nowhere to go when she was at her most troubled.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember the horrible, horrible, nightmarish times that my mother spent in lockdown in psychiatric hospitals, because I'd go and visit her. And then, yes, there was this hope that they would create these community outreach programs and people like my mother would have wonderful care and a great support system. And to some extent, for a short while, there was a program like that in her neighborhood. But then, when Reagan came to office, within, I think, 6 months, it was shut down because of all the budget was cut. And a lot of those people either tried to commit suicide or most of those people ended up on the streets, I think. A third of our homeless population is mentally ill, and they're not out there not getting care. And a lot of people slip through the cracks. And my mother was one of them, unfortunately. But I have to say, the program that helped her at the end of her life, Mental Health Services in Cleveland, these people are I don't know, I call them warriors or angels, or they're just pretty incredible. These people work for very little money, and they go out into the streets and look for homeless people who are mentally ill, and they are determined to find them housing and care. And I stayed very close in touch with them, and they're just, you know, I don't know what would have, you know, I don't know how things would have changed had my mother known them then, way back when, because they didn't exist back in the day. So I'm so glad they're around.
Do you allow yourself to speculate whether or not she would have been better off in a mental institution, and whether or not you and your sister would have been better off in foster care?
Well, my biggest fear when I was growing up was that I would be separated from my sister.
Uh-huh.
So that was part of my secrecy when I was younger. I was just, for some reason, I was convinced that if I was taken away from the family, if someone found out about our family, they would separate us. I don't know why I was convinced of this, but I was. And as horrible, I don't know. You know, I never really speculate about that, what would have been. However, I feel very, as horrific as so much of, you know, my childhood was, I also, you know, I guess I'm a glass half full kind of person, and I think, my God, what gifts my mother gave me, that would I have gotten those gifts? I mean, I knew my mother loved me. She was very loving, and, you know, she was incredibly gifted, and, you know, if I was taken away and put in a foster home, would I, you know, wouldn't have had all those hours sitting next to her at the piano, listening and you know, having this intense musical connection with her. And I don't know. I don't think about it really. I'm glad that I had what I had with my mother, even if it was just little bits and pieces of not normalcy, but, you know, love and little slices of beauty, you know, sort of a kind of fugitive beauty that she offered to me and also to my sister.
Your grandparents lived nearby in Cleveland, and for a time you all moved in with them. But rather than sort of relieving you and your sister of responsibility, there was even more for you to deal with at that point.
Yeah, my grandfather was very old world, and he was rather tyrannical. And my grandmother, my mother's mother, was, you know, a domestically abused wife. You know, mm-hmm. She was, my grandfather beat her, and my grandfather was very threatening physically. He was a very violent man. So we were all terrified of him. However, I did know that he loved me, and he had moments of, you know, kindness. He showed moments of kindness toward me, not really toward my sister. He wasn't very kind to her, but I was his favorite. So there were moments that he was, you know, kind and showed me how to do things, how to garden, how to make, you know, build things with wood and stuff like that. But, you know, my grandmother was terrified of him, and she was kind of a materialistic person and wrapped up with status and how people would view us. We better not tell the neighbors. And
we should say the neighbors all knew about your mother.
Everybody knew about my mother, mm-hmm. but not to the extent, I think, of they didn't know how bad it was,
yeah.
I think, except this one family, the Armstrongs, who were privy to a lot more, you know, a lot more information, because they often came to our rescue. But yeah, it was pretty tough living there. You know, my sister and I were entering middle school, junior high, and, you know, we had hormones raging and we wanted to meet boys. And, well, I was a little bit slow, but my sister certainly wanted to meet boys. And, you know, it's a social time. You want to have friends over. You want to go to your friend's house. And there is no way in hell we're going to have people come over to our place.
Mm-hmm.
So, Yeah, it was a bit complicated. Thank God I had a dog and a bike, because I just would take off on my bike and go far as I could go.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is Mira Bartok. Her memoir is called The Memory Palace. Let's go on the phones to Olivia in Frisco. Hello, Olivia.
Hi. I called because I felt like when you were saying earlier about not going to the grocery store, you know, I have traumatic brain injury myself, and it's not from, I'm not a vet or anything. It happened. And also my husband's mother's, we stopped talking to her because she became, she's had mental problems, but wasn't receiving help. And I just wondered when you chose to stop, did you like cut off all communication with your mother?
First I have to say, I'm so thrilled. You're my very first call-in person ever. Never been on a call-in show before. So, I'll always remember you, I hope.
I'll always remember what you said, because I'll quote it back.
With my mother, you'll have to read the book, but there is a chapter in there where there was a rather dramatic moment where it was very clear that my mother, in 1990, it was very clear that my mother desperately needed to be either hospitalized or she needed to be in some kind of care. She needed to have continuous supervision. She was getting more and more violent. She had attacked my grandmother and stabbed her several times, and then she attacked me, and she lost the house, and a lot of things happened. But ultimately, she disappeared, and at that point, I all she had for me was a post office box in Chicago. I had lied and told her that I had moved, so she wouldn't keep showing up on my doorstep. She was living in Cleveland. I was living in Chicago. But after she lost the house and all these things sort of happened, she just disappeared. And the letters I wrote her came back to me. And at some point, I think it was something like a year or 2 years after that last time I saw her, she showed up in the office of a friend of mine's husband and wanted to know where I was. And at that point, I had a post office box. And it was a different post office box. I can't remember. But anyway, we started communicating through post office boxes. She didn't want to let me know where she was unless I let her know where I was. Hmm. So we play this cat and mouse game. But I really focus in my book about, you know, how I abandoned my mother and all this stuff, largely because of guilt. But in reality, she didn't want me to know where she was until very, very late in the game, until she was really ill and, you know, it was toward the end of her life.
But during the time that you had this post office box contact, you would send her warm clothes and I thought it was really touching that you would paint her things.
Yeah, I made her pictures all the time, and she made me pictures all the time. And she started talking about drawing and painting, and she started sending me little sketches, and I thought, oh, my God, this is great. She doesn't have a piano because she's homeless, but she's channeling this creative energy into something else, and I should help facilitate it. So I started sending her art supplies, and I continued to do that, aside from the warm, you know, hats and mittens and things. But she also sent those to me, too, sometimes for a child who was like 3 or 4, because in her mind I was very small sometimes. You know, I'd get like a little tiny hat or something like that and a little stuffed animal. But she was still trying in her way to be a mother.
She also had, in a lot of her letters and in some of her diary entries, she maintained a sense of humor at times that it would have seemed impossible to have done so.
Thank you for noticing that. I think that my mother had a very, sometimes hilarious, dark sense of humor, mm-hmm. which I have as well. And I really love when people see that in in her writing as well as my writing. Yeah, she did, and you know, I have since connected with her, with some of her friends from childhood. I've actually met my mom's best friend from childhood, who grew up with her, and whose sister owns the piano my mother grew up playing, which was not the piano I grew up playing, and all her old friends say she was a funny person. You know, she was a warm and funny person, and you know, and in her letters to me, that humor sort of became rather dark, but still, you know, still humorous in its way.
Did medication ever work for her, Mira?
It did toward the end of her life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that the cocktail they gave her toward the end of her life worked. And I met one of her social workers when I held this memorial service at the. My sister and I held this memorial service after my mom died. I held this service at the shelter, and I tracked down one of her old social workers who I had never met, who had worked with her, I think, like around the year 2000 or something like that, 2000, 2001, or late 90s. And he said that in one hospitalization, she had responded really well to a certain medication. And she actually, when she got out of the hospital, asked him if she could get a prescription for it, and he was thrilled. But then she never filled it, and then she changed her mind.
My guest is author and artist Mira Bartok. Her memoir is called The Memory Palace. It's available now in trade paperback. We'll come back to this conversation in a couple of minutes and invite you to join us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author and artist Mira Bartok. Her book is called The Memory Palace, a Memoir. It's available now in trade paperback. If you'd like to join our conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Mira, for people who haven't picked up a copy of the book yet, at the start of every chapter, you have illustrations that you did yourself, which are in black and white in the edition I have, but you can see them online in color at your website. It's my understanding that you did the paintings first before every chapter, and then you would write the chapter.
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. I knew what image. The reason the book is called The Memory Palace is, you know, it's the idea is based on an ancient mnemonic system that was revived in the Renaissance by a Jesuit priest named Matteo Ricci, and it's this idea that for everything you want to remember, you create an image, a painting, some kind of image, and you put it in a room inside an imaginary palace in your mind, and every time you want to retrieve that memory, you think of the image that sort of stands for this thing. Now, what I realize is that that doesn't work, that memory is mercurial, that memory is not fixed, but it was a great sort of foundation for me to kind of create a structure to contain whatever memories I have left. And so I knew what images I was going to use, and I drew sketches, and I had started this huge painting on my palace wall of a Renaissance palace facade, where images would come would emerge from underneath arches or doorways or little windows, as if they were hiding, emerging from rooms. And so I started it before. I started the palace before, and I definitely knew what images I was going to make, and I had sketches for them. But then the last month and a half of working on the book is when I finished the whole thing. So it's kind of happened simultaneously.
Did your accident affect your ability to paint or how you painted or what you painted at all?
Yeah, it did. I mean, the very first thing that I wanted to come back was my writing ability, because I had been making a living as a freelance writer, and you know, doing kids' books and doing other kinds of writing. But the art, I lost some hand control and some eye-hand coordination, and that was really frustrating. I still have that problem, but it's not that evident to, you know, most people.
Mm-hmm.
The hardest thing, I think, is I have a little bit of trouble comprehending spatial. My sense of spatial relationships is a little messed up,
mm-hmm.
And it affects the way I draw. And it's hard to start something. I think a lot of TBIers, we call ourselves, have a hard time initiating projects sometimes. And that doesn't necessarily have to do with the art part of my brain. It has to do with just starting something. It's just really difficult. But once I do and I have a system in place, then, you know, it starts to come. But and I'm working on it. I'm working on that and playing music again. Those are, you know, I sort of put those things aside so I could focus on, you know, relearning how to read and write. And but now I'm drawing and playing music more, which is really exciting.
Is it hard, was it hard, particularly when you were first injured, to have to rely on your boyfriend at the time, who I guess is your fiancé or your husband today?
When I first had my accident, I was dating someone briefly who was not a big help. I mean, he was a little bit, but he just wasn't the right person for me. And so I met my husband, my now husband, I've been with for 11 years. I met him several months after my accident, and I really tried to hold it together and pretend nothing was wrong for a while, but
yeah.
He saw through that. And, yeah, it was tough to be dependent on someone in some ways, because I'm such an independent person. And I've just, you know, I've just sort of accepted the fact that I do a lot of things for him, too. And so if he has to cart me around sometimes, that's okay. I can't drive more than 45 minutes or 50 minutes, and there are certain things I can't do, but there are things that he needs me for. So I think it's pretty even.
Mm-hmm.
But in the beginning, it probably was a little lopsided.
What did it take to come to terms with the idea that some things in your life would not be the same?
I'm still working on that, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
I am...
Because you're very young, right? Are you in your late 40s now?
Thank you. No, I'm 52.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the brain is really a strange country. You know, it continues to... It's resilient, and we continue to... everyone's talking about brain neuroplasticity now. Our brains continue to grow, and we rebuild neuropathways, and I know that's happening. You know, there are things that, like, for instance, even my sight, my close-up vision was gone. I wasn't blind, but I couldn't see close-up from the morning after my accident. Now, 2 years ago, and that was in 1999, 2 years ago, my eyesight improved so much I don't need close-up glasses anymore.
Wow.
And now I just started playing the violin again. And, you know, I tried a couple times here and there and didn't do that well. And I just had an amazing lesson this weekend. So I think that we, you know, if we sit in front of the television all day, we're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, so I think you have to keep working. You have to keep working at, you know, working with your brain and what you have, even as you age, even if you don't have a brain injury. So I get frustrated sometimes still about certain things I can't do, but then I'm always amazed at what I can do and what I didn't think I could do, say, a year ago.
Well, it's kind of amazing, and I wouldn't wish your injury on you or anyone else in the world, because I know it did take a lot away and really interfered with a lot in your life, but it does sort of force you to push yourself hard at a time in many people's lives when they're thinking, okay, I've sort of done what I'm going to do, and now I can relax and just sort of glide on in for the rest of my life.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I just went to my 35th reunion, my high school. It's kind of unbelievable I can say that. But, you know, some people came up to me and we were talking and they kept talking about, they couldn't wait till they retired. And I just thought, I am so fortunate that I'm an artist because I don't think like that. Mm-hmm. Brain injury or no brain injury, I never think about retiring. I'm just curious about everything. I hope I never have to stop working at what I love. Even if it means I have to be in a tiny little cottage somewhere and have hardly any money, if I'm still making art, making beautiful things and telling stories. And I mean, I just hope that I'm able to do that until the day I die, or just, you know, or as close to it as I can. So I just have a different a different take on that whole thing. And I don't want to retire. I don't want to stop the party, I guess, that's going on in my head.
I thought it was very sweet, by the way, when your mother was in, you had reunited with her, she was in the hospital, or she was in hospice and she was dying, that you specifically made her pictures of flowers, because it's like something you do for your mom when you're 7, you know, and she's got the flu. And there was just a sweetness to that I think a lot of people lose touch with over time.
You know, I think one of the things that has helped me with my brain injury, returning to art, is to get back to this idea that art is a gift. And so I have to say that, you know, during those years of separation from my mom, when I was struggling with brain trauma, I think the very first thing I made or drew after my brain injury was a flower for her, because I knew she loved flowers. And so it sort of took the pressure off of this is art. And I continued to do that. And she did that for me. Hmm. You know, she made pictures for me. I have all these pictures she made for me. Some flowers, some strange little things, and some horses, and some birds, and all kinds of things she drew.
Let's go back to the phones once again. This time we have Brittany on the line in Dallas. Hey, Brittany.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, if you speak up nice and loud, we sure can.
Okay, hi, Brittany.
Can you hear me now?
Uh-huh.
Well, Mary, I wanted to thank you for writing a book. I've had a similar situation with my mother. She is still alive, but I found your book painful to read, but at the same time comforting. Because sometimes I feel like our society glorifies mothers as, you know, like Mother's Day, and I always felt so much guilt and still do that I can never do enough for her and always put her needs above mine. And, you know, I can totally relate years of no contact with her, but, you know, now she is very elderly, but at the same time it's she would always, you know, say that, you know, there was more crazy blood in me, you know, because she would never always deny it, of course, and I'm sure that's part of her mental illness. But mm-hmm. It was just, again, your book was very comforting, and I want to, you know, celebrate what you have done to overcome so many obstacles, because I know I have in my life struggled with depression and, you know, worried, am I going to be as crazy as my mother? And also, have you found yourself sometimes recreating just that with other relationships, just being drawn to people, say, with that, just similar, you know, characteristics? But again, I do want to thank you so much, because I did find your book very comforting, but at the same time, very painful too.
Thank you, Brittany. I've gotten that response from several people, written me letters. You know, it's not an easy thing to look at, to face, you know, those horrible things that we have in life, and to be, you know, to try to be brave in the face of that. And, you know, the guilt can be overwhelming. The guilt that, you know, what could I have done differently? You know, when you're in a situation like yours, unfortunately, the child is forced to be the adult, is forced to be the parent, and doesn't really get the chance to be, you know, the child who is unconditionally loved by the mother. And that, you know, yes, you do carry that into your other relationships. And you know, it's just, that tragedy never really goes away, I think, you know, that kind of loss. But I think that, you know, at least I can speak for myself that definitely writing about it, and facing, sort of accepting the past and accepting where I am now and doing my best to accept where I am every day certainly helps me through the tough times. You know, it was brave of you to read the book. I don't think it's, you know, I don't think everyone could read this book, you know, if they're not ready to.
Did it make it easier in a way? I mean, I have to imagine you write about this a little bit in the book that, you know, people would say, well, where are you from? And you could say something like, oh, I'm from Cleveland and my parents are divorced, which is true, but it's not really true. Was it easier to sort of put it all out there so that at least you didn't feel like you were lying simply by not telling the whole story?
Well, it's funny you should mention that because I've spent my life, you know, being really, really skilled at those little social conversations, you know, the social interactions that people say, so where are you from? Where are your parents from? What's your dad do? What's your mom do? And I would just go, I would just completely turn the conversation around and put it back on the person, and I would never answer the question. Or I would just be really vague or say something funny. I never wrote this book to sort of let it all out and, you know, let the cat out of the bag. I wrote this book because my mother was getting in the way of all of my art, was getting in the way of fiction, getting in the way of my essays, getting in the way of everything. And I just said, you know, I really have to write her story and let her have her say. And whether or not anyone ever reads this, I have to do it for myself. And it really wasn't until, you know, Free Press, Simon & Schuster picked up the book and the editors there got their hands on this book and started asking me really, really difficult questions. And that's when I started thinking about an audience.
Well, it really is a fascinating piece of work, I think, especially for those of us who don't have direct experience with something like this. And it's made me think in a different way, in particular about people who are homeless. So I thank you so much for writing it and also for talking to us today.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure. I really appreciate your interest and also your people who called in. Thank you so much.
Thank you. The memoir by author and artist Mira Bartok is called The Memory Palace. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.